A very good afternoon, Namibia. You are currently tuned into another edition of On the Reader News Analysis right here on Eagle FM. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and for the next 1 hour and a half, I'll be keeping you informed, engaged, and connected to the stories shaping our nation and the world. Welcome to On the Reader. Today, Wednesday, the 22nd of October 2025, we are deep into the final stretch of the year, and as the weeks rolls by, Namibia's social, economic, and political conversations are only getting more interesting. If you've been looking for a show that breaks down the big news from governance to grassroots, from policy to the people, then look no further. On the Reader News Analysis is your weekday guide to what matters most. Bring you the headlines behind the headlines every Monday to Friday from 1300 hours to 1430. And remember, your voice matters. You can join in on the conversation anytime by calling 083-288-401. Whether it's a comment, a question, or your take on today's topic, we're listening, we're engaging, and we are in it together. A very good afternoon to you. Now, this isn't just about headlines. On the Reader is about deep and dialogue. It's where we interrogate the stories shaping our country, ask the hard questions, revisit past coverage, and connect the dots from archived audio, expert opinions, and sharp analysis. From major policy decisions to everyday realities, we bring you the full story with context and clarity. Now, our interviews are long form and in-depth because our stories deserve more than just sound bites. We come prepared with facts, background, and your questions to make sure every conversation brings us closer to understanding what truly lies beneath the surface. Now, remember, you can catch On the Radar News Analysis live on all Eagle FM frequencies, Eagle FM website, and also our interactive, of course, website. Don't forget to subscribe to our WhatsApp channel for real-time updates, exclusive interview clips, and behind-the-scenes moments. So stay tuned, stay curious, and step beyond the surface. This is On the Reader News Analysis, where Namibia comes to think. And now I'm joined in studio by my colleague David Shombe. Very good afternoon to you, David Shombe, and welcome to On the Reader News Analysis.
Good afternoon, Juju. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah.
Shombe, the Ministry of International Relations and Trade has released a document on strategic planning for the 2025-2030.
Yeah.
Just exactly what does this document contain and what it is all about, David Shombe?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you to our dear listeners. And when we have conversation about external relation, international relation and trade, it's a thing of what do we have in the country and also what are we doing when you go outside. And what the minister has said is actually not quite different from what has been spoken about, particularly at the domestic level. But just to indicate, to say, when it's coming to Namibia, there is a launch of, a new strategic plan, which is 2025 to 2030. And looking at that is it's a final blow to reach 2030.
Yeah.
And maybe to look at the words of the minister and also the words of the ED. One thing that she indicated is to promote aspect of Namibia economic growth. How? Because, Juju, when you have hunger at home, you send people outside to go and represent you so that they can get food, so that they can get connections, so that they can improve the aspect of cultural relations. But it's just a matter of evaluation. And when you look at that document, it's also a matter of, evaluation of how is our Ministry of International Relations and Trade. Because remember, when you look, for example, in South Africa, like this year, they come up with a study to say, no man, we are sending a lot of people outside South African mission, but let us evaluate the contribution of our embassies to South Africa. That's why they closed down some embassies, because the economy is not doing very well. Because they say, no, instead of me having an embassy here, why can't I have just an office operating from the other country, so that we can get assistance. But in fact, it's professionalism. We're looking at that strategic plan. But let us also see what is going to come out, what will be the result of that. Yeah.
Very interesting, Shombe, as I read that the purpose of the strategic plan, the main aim of this strategic plan is to address the ministry's programs
yeah.
and projects and steer the ministry into the direction it plans to be in 2029-2030. And while we are there, just yesterday, I yeah. covered in-depthly one of the projects of the Ministry of International Relations as Minister Selma Shipala Musavi met with Kunene Business Community as part of the ongoing ministerial regional business engagements under the African Continental Free Trade Area.
Hmm.
And one thing I did appreciate, Chombe, about that is that NIPDB was represented at that event.
Yeah.
NAMRA was represented at that event.
Yeah.
And of course, other companies, other stakeholders, that businesses, SMEs can help them to leverage and reach their full potential in businesses were also represented. Just what then do you say also about this strategic plan in helping to reach the ministry's project?
I think the outcome and the implementation of this strategic plan, which is 5 years, will really define what Namibia want to achieve. Because remember now, because traditional diplomacy have changed.
Yeah.
Those days, diplomacy was about politic, security, and military. But now it's more on economic aspect.
Mm.
We don't form friendship because we want to go with somebody. We form friendship because we have hangers at home. When you mention now the board, you mention the engagement with business people, understand that currently as you are speaking, now the ministries are combined. Now it's international relations and also trade. Is to say when you are going outside, you are not only going to speak about political relations, but you are going to speak about businesses, and you are also going to speak about investment. That's why these people, trade and investment, both were supposed to work together. And I think looking at the business aspect is quite a very good thing, because Juju, when you are looking at what you want as a country,
mm-hmm.
and also what we are and what we have, you'll be quite right to say, if we focus more on trading with Africa,
mm-hmm.
like what happened in June, on the 30th of June, when we send our first shipment into Nigeria, we'll be able to realize that's the only way we're going to solve our problem. Due to the unemployment that we have in Namibia will not be solved by us only dealing with our problems at home.
Yeah.
We need friends, real friends,
but,
who understand that you don't just need to send us toys in Namibia. You need to send us experts that will teach us to make business. And I think that is the responsibility of the ministry to make sure that we are marketed outside the country, and everybody who is sent out understand what it wants, and also domestically, because this is not only things of outside, because you business young business people to say they must also engage to say, what can we do to sell outside, what can we do even if you know to sell. There are a lot of conferences being attended, Juju.
They are being
organized and attended by young people in Africa. Just, people are in Rwanda. How many Namibians there? 3 or 1 or 0. People are in Egypt. Okay. Young people in business. But because there is no that clear understanding and maybe simplification, because that was not really, the field of, a lot of people by those years, but now, they have to get into that.
But then again, we also have this conferences being organized right here in our Namibia, in our land of the brave.
Yeah.
But the question also remains to say, Shombe, are young people really partaking or making sure that they are going to this conferences so that they can benefit from this conferences? That's a good question to ask myself and to ask the listeners at home, the small medium enterprises, whether they are really making time of this opportunity to ensure that they attend this conferences, like I said about yesterday's engagement for that matter. All those companies represented brought in one in one office, yet some of the people will still not show up. But with that being said, we pause now here for a short commercial break. We'll be back to continue just the last bit with David Shambe. Stay tuned.
Great news. Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
And we are back. Like I told you, we are joined in studio by David Shombe. We're talking about the Ministry of International Relations strategic plan, or release of its strategic plan for 2025 to 2030. Now, Shombe, the ministry also speaks about that they seek to strengthen bilateral and multilateral relations and enhance economic cooperation efforts through various engagements.
Yeah.
I must highlight that, such as the state and official visits by national commissions. For instance, how we just had Botswana here. Joint commissions of cooperation, diplomatic and political consultations. And Shombe, you started, you stayed off in the very beginning of our conversation to say that if we are going to develop Namibia, we're not going to do it by ourselves. We need friends and partners. Why is this very important, Shombe? And also just reflect to us about Namibia's and Botswana's bi-national commission.
The one thing that you need to look at is that the area of international relation is almost everything domestically outside Namibia.
Yeah.
Everything that you do at home outside. Now, the bilateral relationship should be evaluated, because hosting a bilateral relationship, a bilateral relation meeting, for example, between head of state is a very expensive business, but they must also be tangible. Because we must learn to say not only meetings, but we evaluate the resources and we evaluate the outcome. Botswana has a lot to tell us and also to teach us.
Yes.
Because I've been speaking at my shows to say, Duma Mboko is a negotiator. And when you look at where the BIAS is now, they have to either agree or they have to renegotiate. Say, no, I can't be in my own country. Then I only have 15% in diamond industry.
Yeah.
Now, what can we learn from that bilateral relation to say, let's go and ask to say, how are you progressing at that, and what can we do in Namibia?
Take ownership of what is yours.
Juju, if somebody asks you,
and
it's not an offense question to say, is it fair in Namibia uranium industry, for example, Rossing Uranium, now is a different name, how much Namibian government has? It's not 7%. And it's something
serious?
That, and it's something that we should not really to say, be varied about it, but let us be straightforward and say, what diplomatic method are you going to use? It's not only about diplomacy on the table, but effective diplomacy to say, how can we deal with, expanding our economy? And I like the fact that, like the beginning of this year, in terms of Namibia bilateral relations with Nigeria.
Yeah.
Nigeria have been a very good partner of Namibia, but when you look at their trade composition, it was low compared to other countries. But now Nigeria is doing very well. They are entering the market of the US in terms of oil and gas, and they are expanding in terms of their economy. And I think with the shipment of salt to Nigeria, I think they something that need to be praised. It must be more than that. And I know you are the good friend of, you also support that, that area, especially when it's coming to Nigeria and also, that business. I understand that, but
I've personally noticed that the Minister of International Relations and Trade, Sama Shipala Musavi, has been traveling quite a lot to other countries. I think she has done more travels than the president herself. And for some people who sit at home and say, why is it that she's traveling so much? Why is it so significant that she actually visit those partners, Shombe?
It's actually respectively, it's a role to travel. Foreign affairs, you don't need to stay at home.
True.
Your job is to travel around the world and make friendship.
Yeah.
Your job is to travel around the world and
Shombe, continue.
Is to travel around the world and make friendship, but real friendship. And Juju, if you look at but there is quite a lot of significant events that we can give, but the fact of the matter must remains to say, this strategic plan by 2030, what are you going to discuss about? What will be the result? Because a draft is good, but what are you going to discuss about? But let's hope that with NDP6 and with also the resources that we have, it will be a success, because everybody wants things to succeed.
Certainly.
Yeah.
David Shombe, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reading is Analysis. It's a pleasure to have you always in the studio with us.
Thank you, Juju. I'm always happy to be here.
Okay. And there we had it from David Shombe. Let's pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. Of course, this is On The Radar News Analysis. We're just getting started. Stick around.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts of previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Welcome back. In other news, the International University of Management, also known as IUM, today handed over medical equipment worth 8.5 million Namibian dollars, that is, to the Rundu State Hospital. Now, speaking at the handover ceremony, Professor Philemon Amambo from the IUM Advisory School of Medicine Board stated the equipment is specifically earmarked for Rundu State Hospital, one of the major hospitals in the northern eastern part of Namibia. Professor Amambo challenged the long-standing perceptions surrounding the country's healthcare landscape, noting that for decades there has been discomfort with how some of Namibia's potentially best hospitals have been undervalued. He questioned who is at the periphery from whom and why. He added that we want our people to experience hope and confidence where they are. Let's now take a listen to Professor Amambo, that is Philemon Amambo.
Common good. And number three, it demonstrates a contribution towards societal benefits that promote the building of a just and egalitarian society through innovation. Now, the MOs that was referred to will continue to be guiding torch of the operations, and I believe it's likely to be a living document. Namibia, this country, a country well known for its high Gini coefficient, one of the highest in the world, the country of inequality. Something needs to be done. Through training, we would like to rectify what is identified to be wrong. May not be comfortable, but if it is wrong, it deserves to be rectified. We would like to attempt to identify credible trainers from wherever and to raise credible trainers from within as time goes. in service provision in our facility. We are dreaming the best, the very best for our people. Unrestricted. Only those who believe in what, in something else, something we do not believe in, may continue to keep us where we are or where we have been all along. But we shall continue to dream the best for this nation. The only one we have, we can claim.
Speaking also at the handover ceremony is Minister of Health and Social Services, that is Esperanza Luvindao, accepting this equipment donation from the International University of Management, IUM.
And I wish to highlight very importantly that if you listen to his speech, you would actually realize that it wasn't 8.5 million. If you listen very carefully. So he said there are a lot of costs that are being borne by the International University of Management. And so very easily I would put this at nearly $10 million, if I'm not mistaken. If not million. And so today we're not here to celebrate a small donation. We're here to celebrate this commitment to the well-being of the Republic of Namibia. Now, I say this because I've said it time and time again at numerous speaking engagements, and I've said so many people can find fault in the system. Many people. No, the health ministry this, the health ministry that. No, the government this, the government that. But it's very few people that can see a problem and be a part of the solution. Generous act of the International University of Management, particularly with this memorandum of understanding with the Ministry of Health and Social Services, solidifies something. It says something, it speaks towards something. When I started, the President said something to me. The Right Honourable Prime Minister highlighted this and he said, we have a leadership that has a soft spot for health. And I don't think we quite understand or appreciate what that means. I've been to countries after my appointment where you can see that health is just not a top priority. And so to have leadership that is healthcare focused, that believes that health is a priority, is not something to be taken for granted. One of the first things the President said to me when I was appointed, she said, I want you to build capacity. I want you to build in-house capacity. That and get rid of the middleman. But she said, I want you to build capacity. I want you to build local capacity. And so as we stand here today to celebrate this particular donation, it also speaks to the fact that we have a very responsive government. We have a government that in no way says that there is no work to be done, but we have a government that says that we recognize there is work to be done. We vow to get the job done. And yes, we might start with tiny steps, but that's how you start the journey. And so with that said, the donation today speaks towards what I like to emphasize as being the well-being of our citizens. Now, when we started talking about this issue of vision, April 2026, there were a few comments that disturbed me. One of them was a misunderstanding, a misconception of what this vision was about. So people started saying, yes, but vision April 2026 is to get government health facilities ready for VIPs, for the Right Honourable Prime Minister and the Minister and the President. And I very quickly jumped in and corrected them. That's not what I'm doing. I'm glad media is here again to reiterate this fact. Vision April 2026 is not there to get facilities ready for VIPs. Vision April 2026 states that if it is good enough for the Namibian citizen from Havana, Hakahana, you name it, oh, then it should be good enough for the Minister of Health and Social Services. And if it's good enough for the patients, it should be good enough for the Right Honourable Prime Minister. So ultimately what we are trying to do is not get it fit for purpose for executives or VIPs. We're trying to get it to a standard whereby all people, irrespective of background, irrespective of where you come from, irrespective of how much money you have in your pocket, you can access the same quality of care. That I have with our current healthcare system, and I say ours because I'm an active part of it, active contributor to it. When you go to health facilities and the president is in the region, and I know a lot of you know this, if the president or a high functioning official is in the region, they have this facility that they prepare, a room, a special room. And the interesting thing is the same hospitals that say, no, we don't have ECG machines, we don't have this, we don't have that for the patients. Now suddenly that room will have everything. Has everything. And so that means that somewhere along the lines we've gotten it wrong. Somewhere along the lines we need to change the way we perceive it. And that's why I say the well-being of our citizens, and I highlight this every time I speak to healthcare workers, is the patients are the VIPs. As a ministry, we are well aware of the contribution, and I want to take a moment because oftentimes we have events like this, we go through them, we say thank you very much, IUM, and we move on. But I want to highlight what exactly this 8.5 million means. I'm not going to read through everything, but the healthcare workers that are with us will understand, and I'm glad the superintendent of Rundu Hospital is here. The healthcare workers will understand what exactly this donation means. I wish to highlight this importantly because from the time I've taken office, we've had to engage in partnerships and conversations where we are asking for 100,000, 250,000, you name it, whatever amount, 1 million, 2 million, you name it. And so I want to put into effect what exactly this donation means so that we don't brush over it and just think that, oh, it's just another donation. You know, it's a PR, we move on. No. Then I wish to highlight very importantly.
And here now, the Minister of Health and Social Services, Esperanza Lumindao, highlights the type of equipment that the International University of Management has donated to the state and to Rundu State Hospitals, to be specific.
So first, I want to highlight, and I want to highlight some of the important items that I've noted. So they are donating a sonar machine. They are donating an endoscopic tower. They're donating, please clap your hands. They're donating hospital parameter, ICU hospital patient monitors. They're donating warmers. They're donating medical UV air sterilizers. They're donating air electric operation tables with X-ray examination. They are donating operating tables for orthopedic traction frames. They are donating new infant incubators for babies. They're donating anesthetic machines. They're donating electrosurgical generators. They're donating digital color Doppler ultrasound. They're donating fetal monitors. They're donating hospital infusion pumps. They're donating system medical ventilators. They're donating infant warmers for newborns. They're donating an LED endoscope light source. They're donating emergency trolleys, gas CEO insufflators, irrigation aspiration pumps. They're donating laparoscopes. They're donating equipment worth 8.5 million Namibian. Now, with that said, ladies and gentlemen, my task is simple: to offer some remarks and then to welcome the Right Honourable Prime Minister. But before I do that, I want to highlight something that I've been highlighting at every official handover donation that I attend. I say we must highlight the importance of maintenance. That's important. And I said it, so last night I was with the Minister of Works and Transport at Kapstra Hospital until 10 p.m. with the medical superintendent as well and her entire team. And there's some things that we just need to get right. There's some things that we need to get right. And one of those things is proper maintenance. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It doesn't matter if you live in a shack and you cannot keep that shack clean, and you're not worthy of a mansion. And it speaks volumes about your ability to own a mansion. And so a lot of the times you hear people complaining and saying, yes, but we don't have the right tools in the hospitals. But when the right tools come, 6 months later, I'm getting a notice. No, firstly, there's nobody that was responsible to oversee the equipment. There's no maintenance plan. It's missing parts. You do a visit at the hospital and then you're told, no, there's something wrong with that bed. We don't know what it is. It's now packed in a corner. And so if we're going to talk about accepting, which we are, this brilliant donation, we must be honest about the importance of maintenance. And like I said, I'm glad the superintendent is here to take back the message home. Now, as a nation, we have been making steady progress towards achieving ambitious objectives outlined in the ministerial strategic plan and the roadmap for 2030. We have a very bold vision for healthcare. Very bold vision. And when I started, I was told, my goodness, as Brant, it's a mammoth task that you've been given. Do you think it's possible to get it right? And then I traveled to a few countries, and I traveled to a country with a population of about 120 million people. And there are things in healthcare that they're getting right that for some reason we, with a population of 3 million people, have not gotten right. And so then I go back to the comments about it being a mammoth task and it being impossible. And I said, I don't think it's impossible. I think there are certain things that we need to change, and there are certain things we need to get right. And once we do, it will be possible. I extend my sincere appreciation to IUM as well as other private sector actors who have been contributing towards the development of our healthcare system. Your contribution and your support, particularly in ensuring that we improve the quality of care, does not go unnoticed. Before I conclude, I would like to express my sincere gratitude to the Right Honourable Prime Minister for his unwavering support and leadership of the healthcare sector. I put him through a lot. I'm always texting and calling at all times of the night. And you know how it is, everybody feels like their ministry is always important, it can't wait. But he's always there to pick up the calls. When there is an emergency, he is there to respond. And as I mentioned, we are fortunate to have leaders that see healthcare as a priority. And so, ladies and gentlemen, it is now my distinct honor to introduce to you a man that needs little to no introduction. He's a true champion of healthcare. He's a visionary leader. He's committed to building a healthier and more prosperous nation. And the one thing about the Prime Minister, the Right Honorable Prime Minister, is he doesn't see obstacles. I thought I don't see obstacles. The Right Honourable Prime Minister does not see obstacles. So when I tell him we don't have this, that, he says, okay, but do it. What's wrong? And those are the kind of leaders that we need, because for so long the system has taught us that it needs to undergo a long process for things to happen.
And there you had it from the Minister of Health and Social Services, Esperanza Lumindao, speaking on the importance of proper maintenance of equipment and highlighting how in some cases equipments are not well taken care of by the staff themselves. And she appreciated how the superintendent of Rundu State Hospital, to which $8.5 million of worth of equipment has been donated to them by the International University of Management. And this is something really to appreciate the university, a very big gesture to appreciate the university of donating such an amount of equipment. And the Right Honorable Prime Minister Eliang Gerayre at the event spoke about how he's also very appreciative that the equipment was donated to Rundu State Hospital. And I understand why he would mention those sentiments, because we often look only to our hospitals in the urban areas, but forget about the rural areas. Yet we save so much money by buying the necessary equipment for a particular hospital in a rural area, because we don't have to spend so much money by sending a lot of these patients and referring them to Katutura State Hospital, which is the country's referral hospital, major referral hospital. People will be coming from Kathmandu, people will be coming from just to come and do a procedure that could very well be done at the location or at the place where they are, provided that the health personnel that are able to do that procedure are there. But what usually hinders this is because the right equipment is not in place in those state hospitals. Now, of course, if the Ministry of Health wants to save a lot of money, and of course, I understand that they have already gotten this mandate, they will need to provide the right equipment at the right facilities at the state hospitals. Also, one thing that I've always spoken about right here is how state hospitals send patients to private hospitals and spend a lot of money. The Right Honorable Prime Minister Eliang Gerayre gave an example of one of a close meeting that they were having with the president, that is Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah, to say they were speaking about a particular time where patients have to be sent to private hospitals, and about 150 million per year. She asked, how much do you spend at the end of the year? And she was told by that health personnel that about 150 million Namibian dollars is spent every year just to send those patients to private hospitals. And she asked, how much is that particular equipment? And the equipment that was mentioned was less than 50 Namibian dollars. And she asked 50 million Namibian dollars. And she asked, why haven't you bought this equipment? So you see how really it's a trend that has become so common, especially motor vehicle accident patients that are constantly sent to private hospitals, because basically at home or in the state hospitals, a particular equipment is not there to help alleviate or to help treat that particular patient, which is a lot of money being spent. Now, obviously, if we do buy the equipment, we cut that issue short. We cut that problem short. But let's pause here right now and take a trip to the marketplace. When we return, I will be educating you on just what are the functions of some of those equipments that were donated.
You've leveled up in life, and now it's time to level up your contract. MTC is changing the game with our new contract data plans. More data, more voice minutes, and more SMSs. Core of everything you need. Plans start from just $199 per month. And for a limited new customer's score, an extra 10 gigabytes of data valid for 90 days, absolutely free. Don't wait. Visit any MTC mobile home or call 12000 to level up today. MTC, make the connection.
Welcome back. And just some of the equipments that were donated and their functions. I'm just mentioning a very few of them. It's a whole list of many equipment. One is infant radiant warmer for newborns. And the functions of it is that it provides controlled heat to newborn babies who cannot regulate their body temperature. It also keeps infants warm immediately after birth or during medical examinations and procedures, hence reducing the risk of hypothermia. A portable all-in-one endoscope. The functions of it, it's used to view the inside of the body's organs or cavities without major surgery. It helps doctors diagnose and sometimes treat conditions in areas such as the digestive tract, the respiratory tract, or the urinary system. Being portable makes it ideal for use in various hospital departments or field settings. I guess CO2 insufflator. It is used during laparoscopy, that is a minimal invasive procedure, surgeries to pump carbon dioxide gas into the abdominal cavity. Now, this inflates the area, giving surgeons better visibility and space to operate safely. Also, a medical IUV sterilizer. It uses ultraviolet UVC light in order to kill or deactivate airborne bacteria, viruses, and pathogens in hospital rooms or operating theaters. It also improves air quality and reduces the risk of infection. Electrosurgical generator. It generates high-frequency electrical currents used during surgery in order to cut tissue, coagulate, that is to stop bleeding, or destroy abnormal tissue. It allows for precise surgical control with minimal blood loss. Now, an electrical dermatome. It is a surgical equipment used to cut thin, even layers of skin, typically for skin grafts in burns or reconstructive surgery. Now, the electric motor ensures accuracy and consistency in the thickness of the skin lysis. A 19-inch full digital color dropper ultrasound is a diagnostic imaging device that uses sound waves to create real-time images of internal organs, tissues, and blood flow. Now, the color dropper features shows the direction and the speed of blood flow, helping detect blockages or abnormalities. A fetal monitor, it monitors the heartbeat of the fetus or the unborn baby and the uterine contractions during pregnancy and labor. It also helps healthcare workers assess the baby's well-being and detect any signs of distress. An electronic operating table with X-ray examination capability. Now, this one is a monitorized surgical table that can be adjusted for weight, tilt, and position in order to suit various procedures. The X-ray compatibility allows for imaging during operations without moving the patient and improving precision and efficiency. And all this equipment and more at the value of $8.5 million was donated today by the International University of Management to the Rundu State Hospital. With that being said, let's pause right here. This is On the Radar News Analysis. Should you be interested in participating in the news analysis or asking questions, please don't hesitate to dial in on studio 083-288-401. Yes, standby in studio. I'll see you after the commercial break.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts or previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and now brace yourself for economic indicators and trading economics thereafter. Now, US dollar today is equal to 17 Namibian dollars and 48 cents. One Swiss franc is equal to 21 Namibian dollars and 59 cents. One Australian dollar is equal to 11 Namibian dollars and 33 cents. £1 sterling is equal to 23 Namibian dollars and 29 cents. £1 sterling is equal to 1 Namibian dollar and 22 cents. And now for trading economics. The volume of mortgage applications in the U.S. inched lower by 0.3% from the previous week of the pending and of the period ending October 17th, marking the fourth consecutive weekly decline. Now, the muted movement occurred despite a 5 BPS drop in a benchmark mortgage rate, tracking the decline in longer maturity treasury yields amid growth concerns and the outlook of rate cuts by the Fed. Wholesale prices in Ireland fell 2.6% year-on-year in September 2025, easing from a 3.0% decline in the previous month. Now, this marked the eighth consecutive month of deflation, although the pace of the decline has softened over the past 4 months as prices rose faster for food products. On a monthly basis, wholesale prices edged down 0.4% in September, following a flat reading in August. Silver prices fell to below $48.5 per ounce on Tuesday, maintaining the 7% sell-off from the previous session as markets considered whether the metal's recent surge propelled it to the overbought territory. Now, silver prices in major exchange had rallied near 40% since the end of September to reach a record high of $54.5 per ounce on October the 17th. Now, precious metals benchmarks surge as U.S. government shutdown, increasing geopolitical tension worldwide, and unsustainable fiscal deficits for major economies drove investors and governments to pile on hard currency and bullion as preferred store of value. Belgium's consumer confidence indicator stalled in October 2025 from -1 in the previous month, signaling a shift toward a neutral sentiment following 21 consecutive months of negative readings. Expectations regarding unemployment turned negative at -6.2 in August, suggesting that consumers foresee better job prospects, ahead. Moreover, the propensity to save urged higher. Now, on the other hand, sentiment toward the general economic outlook at -20 versus -21 continue to deteriorate, while consumers' views on their future financial situation at -2 versus 0 tend pessimistic. And that's what we had for you today in terms of economic indicators. We pause here now, take a trip to the marketplace. When we return, we'll tell you what's making headlines in terms of news beyond the borders of Namibia. Stay tuned right here on the Radar News Analysis.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts or previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Now brace yourself for news beyond the borders of Namibia. We start off regionally, move over to continental news. Thereafter, we bring you some international news. Now, starting off in South Africa, where concerns are being raised that South Africa could turn into a mafia state. Let's take a listen.
Over the years, South Africa has been faced with numerous issues. Although progress is being made, the country continues to grapple with more than 8 million unemployed, corruption in the public sector, and inequality causing discontent. In an article in the Sunday Times, the chairman of the Youth Employment Service and former CEO of Goldman Sachs in sub-Saharan Africa, Colin Coleman, says the country is turning into a mafia state due to failures to uphold the law, and new measures need to be introduced to prevent possible volatile security unrest before the country holds its 2029 national elections. Well, we've got Colin with us this morning, so let's jump straight into that conversation. Thank you, Colin. Thanks very, very much for joining us here on the program. You know, when we look at South Africa at the moment and all of the stories that we're covering, we are at the moment so focused on particularly crime, because in every direction we're looking at, whether it be the Parliamentary Ad Hoc Committee, whether we're talking about the Madlanga Commission, or whether we're crossing to a mass shooting in Westbury where youths are being shot in the open streets of South Africa. Let's talk to what is making South Africa this fertile ground for the rise of all of these criminal networks.
Yeah, it's extremely concerning, Leanne, and thanks for having me on your show. I must say, what I'm not saying is that South Africa is not a constitutional democracy. In fact, when I'm saying that I believe that South Africa is at risk, that we won't be able to maintain this government until the elections in 2029, that there may be an early election call, it's because there is so much rising instability, scandals, and so on and so forth. And neither am I saying that we have a mafia state in the sense of some of the countries we see elsewhere, say, for example, in Russia, where you have a dominant central leader. In fact, what we are seeing is a wide distribution of the rise of connections between political and criminal networks at local government, provincial government, and at central government levels in the state. And that distribution is more happening in a vacuum. And
goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinter nuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. Is jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet? Kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
Let's resume that conversation about concerns that South Africa could turn into a mafia state.
In the context of this very wide unemployment situation where literally half of South Africans marginalized from the formal economy, the danger is that as you see the rise of the taxi mafia, the construction mafia, the illegal underground mafia, et cetera, that those criminal networks will crowd out formal employment and formal investment and formal jobs because it creates an environment of instability and uncertainty where business who wants to invest in the economy and has cash on hand to invest it will hold it back because it's uncertain whether there is an environment of stability in which to invest. So it's a circular process of saying, as we engage in a situation where there's such high unemployment, structural problems, inequality, we need to redouble our efforts to include people in the economy. And I certainly see it from the youth employment side. You know, we've had great success in the youth employment service with placing now 200,000 youth in 1,900 businesses, generating 11.5 billion rand in salaries for those youth. But in the context of 12 million people looking for work who can't find it or are locked out of the economy, that's a drop in the ocean. And so we need to redouble efforts to get economic growth, investment and job creation.
So let's talk to the youth, because obviously this is a very young continent. It's a young country. We've got over half the population are the youth in South Africa. It's a strong, vibrant community, but we have certainly seen around, you know, this continent and basically around the world as well, that the youth are not relating to the leadership that we have, that it's getting to a dangerous point where they're starting to take the law into their own hands. You speak of a mafia state, and the incident, I'm just giving the latest incident, there's so many that happened in Westbury where we are seeing shootings, we are seeing gangs, we are seeing literally a mafia state playing out in our streets. I mean, these kids are not going to school. We hear this. We spoke to the grandmother who said they don't go to school. They're wearing fancy clothes, but who knows what they're doing to get this. And this is the reality, is that the youth are being let down by everybody, it seems. So how do we turn this around when the youth are basically the ones that are suffering most?
Absolutely. I mean, we need to see economic growth. We've had economic growth of 1% for 15 years. That's below population growth. So in practice, South Africans are getting poorer on a GDP per capita basis. And we need to effectively stimulate the economy and see economic growth. We're going to have our budget in February. We took 6 months to approve the last budget. And that budget is going to need to invest money in productive investment. You know, salaried consumption is not going to drive growth. So we need, in order to get youth off the street and jobs created, we need to get public programs, we need to get the market to work effectively, and we need to get the confidence in business to effectively invest in long-term projects in South Africa, fixed investment, to get that kind of investment going and foreign investment. And that is a circular process. So we need to solve the security problems on the ground, and we need to create an environment in which business invests with confidence in the economy.
Yeah. Also, this talk of a mafia state, and I know you speak about it a lot, but then again, all of us do, unfortunately. It seems to be a word that's coming out of all of our mouths. I mean, I did an interview yesterday where we were talking about the water mafia, where we literally are paying, and this is just in Tshwane, 777 million rand on water tankers, whereas that money is not actually being used to fix the decay and infrastructure that we are seeing in municipalities around the country. I mean, that was just one example in Tshwane. This happens throughout the country. We talk mafias in infrastructure, in water, in the protection services. It has actually gone into almost every aspect of our lives. Where do we begin when we sit and listen to commissions where we don't even know if the law enforcement is in order right now, and if that's not being run by the mafia? Talk to us. Where do we begin? How do we fix this?
As I say, right now, I think many of these illegal criminal organizations are feeding off the merging of political and criminal networks, tenders, and so on and so forth. And we need to see effective action against wrongdoing. Now, obviously, the Zondo Commission pointed to significant problems within the political networks at the top, but we've seen no action in respect of that. So, as I say, we're creating a vacuum in which there is no consequence for wrongdoing in South Africa, apparently. So we need to fix the legal and judicial pipeline, identifying crime and then prosecuting crime. You know, I saw a report that 12 lawyers have been assassinated in South Africa who are pursuing legal cases or who are pursuing business rescue cases. And this is extremely concerning if there's this kind of attack on the legal system in South Africa, then people won't want to be involved in these prosecutions. So we absolutely need to redouble our efforts on both the security side and on the economic growth side to get action. And this is urgent. So my call is not to say, you know, we're losing our constitutional democracy. We had an era of state capture under Zuma in which he was very careful to act within the constitution. So the point isn't, is this happening within a constitutional state? It is. But the problem is that this is happening at the cost of our institutions. It's happening at the cost of our economy. We know how it hammered our economy under the state capture regime. And if we allow these criminal syndicates to effectively operate without impunity, left, right, and center, aided by political networks, we're going to find ourselves in the coming years in a much worse off situation. So we really need to call to account the politicians, the parties, the government of national unity to redouble its efforts to get on top of this problem.
So one of the questions.
Now, of course, over the years, South Africa has been faced with numerous issues. And although progress is being made, the country continues to grapple with more than 8 million unemployed, corruption in the public sector, and inequality causing discontent. Now, in an article in the Sunday Times, co-chaired of the Youth Employment Service and former CEO Goldman Sachs in the Sub-Saharan Africa, Colleen Coleman says the country is turning into a mafia state due to failures to uphold the law and new measures needed to be introduced in order to prevent possible volatile security unrest before the country holds its 2029 national elections. Now, if you've been to South Africa as a Namibian and doing a comparison between Namibia and South Africa, me personally, as I was in Johannesburg, South Africa, I was so scared walking those streets of Joburg. I sort of fear that I really just grabbed me to say, oh my God, will you survive? Will you make it out alive here? And we were so cautioned to say, don't ask directions from anybody in the streets. You know, this is the country where, unfortunately, daylight robbery, and of course we do have robberies here in Namibia, but the way it has escalated in South Africa is really a cause of concern, where people can be murdered in daylight. But nonetheless, perhaps discussions are on the table to make it better. Now let's take a listen to a conversation on what is the attraction for teenagers to get involved with gangs. Let's take a listen.
Two teenagers were shot and killed and four others wounded in a shooting incident in Westbury, Johannesburg earlier today. According to police, preliminary reports suggest that the shooting was gang-related.
The police in Sophia Town responded to a shooting incident in Westbury on the 21st of October 2025, where six teenagers were shot dead. The victims were rushed to hospital, where two of them were declared dead on arrival and four are receiving medical attention. Preliminary reports suggest that the shooting was gang-related. It is reported that the six, aged between 14 and 19 years, were shot dead by three suspects believed to be from a rival gang. The Provincial Anti-Gang Unit is on the scene together with SAPS Forensic Services. District Crime Intelligence has been mobilized to assist the anti-gang unit with the tracing of the suspects.
Criminologist at the University of the Free State, Dr. Ashel Phillips, specializes in youth gang subcultures and occult gangs, joins us now for more on this. Dr. Phillips, good evening. Thank you so much for your time. It is the same areas, the same neighborhoods, and the same regions that seem to have reoccurring events of gun violence, particular, and gun-related deaths that seem to happen around gangs in particular. Given that we know where it happens, why is it that law enforcement has not been able to crack down on gangs operating in such communities to bring an end to the scourge of gun violence?
Good evening. Thanks a lot for having me. Look, the police definitely are facing multiple challenges in addressing the gang issue and the issue of gang-related violence. And although there have been some sporadic successes, it unfortunately is not always sustainable. So there are multiple factors that lead to gang membership and gang violence. And the police tend to take a reactive response rather than a preventative one. So in other words, reacting after an event or a shooting or a violent-related incident has occurred. So preventing it definitely from that angle is going to be nearly impossible.
Let's talk about teenagers, particularly as early and new recruits into gangs. What is it? What's the attraction and the allure for teenagers to get into gangs and to take up gun violence, as we've seen out play out in Westbury?
The typical age for gang membership usually is between 12 and about 24 years. And there, as I said previously, are multiple risk factors. So the key ones would definitely be absent male figures or absent father figures. So older members within these gangs then immediately start filling a dominant male role in the lives of these youth. And they are then seen as role models. They are hero worship. There's valor and honor related to it. They definitely feel a state of belonging and respect that sometimes may be absent from school or from the family or community. They definitely within the gang have access to material wealth, which they otherwise would not have due to issues of youth unemployment and poverty. And then there are multiple other factors which range from academic failure to deviant peer affiliation, generational gang membership within families. So it's really a multidimensional aspect, that lead young people to join in gangs.
If we were to, cut the umbilical cord that seems to be the recruiting pipeline for young people, particularly early teens, into gangsterism, what would be the lowest hanging fruit for us to be attacked collectively to ensure that fewer young boys go into gangsterism? You've mentioned a number of things there, and different parts of society that plays or feeds into this, the home, the school, the community, the family structure. Collectively, where would we begin and what would be the easiest?
I think the best approach to take would definitely be to take a holistic approach where we start viewing, gangsterism and youth gang membership not merely as a government issue or a South African police service issue, but an issue that we need to address at family level and at community level as well. So in other words, trying to come up with ways to substitute for the benefits of gang membership, establishing, really strong bonds within families, giving youth a sense of belonging within the family, building that close relationship, establishing external networks within communities, within religious organizations, so that you also make up for or account for the spiritual and the cultural elements related to gang membership and gang involvement. And then as well, trying to address, issues related to poverty and youth unemployment, which is a particular concern in South Africa. And that could be done through promoting entrepreneurship already at school level, creating gang awareness at school level, so that youth know what exactly it is that they are getting themselves into even before they become initiated into the gang. Because once that happens, it becomes extremely difficult to get them out again.
What's the youngest age at which we begin to speak to children about gangsterism? Because if you say someone at the age of 12 are, eligible for recruitment into gangs, it means that a child in grade 6 or 7 of primary school is already a target.
Unfortunately, yeah, that's the reality that we live in. So where the typical age is between 12 and 24 years, you do get young people as young as 6, 7 or 8 years that are already recruited into gangs. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, young people are an easy scapegoat for gang members and specifically gang leaders, as they are usually used as hitmen or they are used as drug mules. They are quite easy to manipulate. They have an underdeveloped death concept or fear of death. And a lot of the times these young people are so desperate, you know, due to poverty and unemployment, especially within the family, that they are willing to do close to anything if it means extending your survival or eating material meat.
Talk to me about some of the dangerous practices that teenagers get involved in gangs and gang culture.
I think the most dangerous would also be the most common one, where they would get involved in murder, usually sexual offenses which involve rape. Definitely extortion. So you have a lot of the time, you know, where gangs now engage in protection fees, and we have practices related to any form of violence, whether it be assault, whether it be ritual stabbings, you know. Then obviously the drug trade, that's also a very big activity, and that also leads to and creates a lot of violence. So there is escalation in gang violence, obviously because of territory or due to turf wars, because those are the areas used to trade drugs and where the biggest profits are made. So unfortunately in our case, what we tend to do is we tend to address it at the lowest levels, but we don't really dismantle the gang as a unit. So we don't really get to the middlemen or higher ups. We don't dismantle the organized criminal trade, whether it be in human trafficking or in drug trafficking. And then obviously, a lot of the time there are spiritual and cultural components to gangs as well, and very few, if any, rehabilitation or prevention programs also address gangs from that angle.
When you say spiritual and cultural elements to it, what does that look like?
Look, what you usually would have happening is that, you know, a contemporary development is that gangs are actually starting to incorporate elements of demon or devil worship, and then, you know, practices related to the use of muti or traditional African medicine. This is used to further their criminal activity, but also in certain instances it has been reported to be used to evade arrest, you know, to have success in court cases, to avoid convictions and that sort of thing. So that again opens up gangs to the trade in organ harvesting and organ trafficking, but then obviously it also links to muti murder.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Ashwell Phillips, thank you so much for your time this evening. Really do appreciate it.
Now move over to Zambia, where the youth have urged, to safeguard Zambia's peace.
Colonialism was a dark period in Zambia's history, marked by oppression, exploitation, and marginalization. Women in particular bore the brunt of colonial rule, facing discrimination, violence, and exclusion from decision-making processes. Despite these challenges, women played a crucial role in the fight against colonialism. They were the backbone of freedom struggle, providing support, mobilizing communities, and risking their lives for the cause. Women like Mama Betty Chilunga were instrumental in the fight against colonialism.
There were three committees that were formed under the Women's League where I was. The Peace Committee, Development Committee, and also the Rights Committee. These three committees, I was in development. Other women were in the Peace Equality Committee. And we started now fighting for those rights of women. Before independence, my daughter, women were not allowed to get loans. Before independence, women were not allowed to own land. Before independence, women were not allowed to go on paid maternity leave. Women were not allowed to work on the mines. So there were a division of work. Work for men and work for women.
Veteran freedom fighter in National Freedom Fighters Association of Zambia, National Secretary for Women Affairs, Mama Bessie Chanda, highlights the role women played to support the fight against colonialism.
Looking after our top leaders, feeding them, fetching water for them, preparing rallies, encouraging us to go on campaigns. By that time, I was a youth. Our mothers encouraged us to do a lot of things.
For Rosemary Mumba, growing up in colonial times motivated her to pursue education and break the stereotype.
I wanted to be able to read and write. I think that was the syllabus. The syllabus was that the women had to learn to read and write so that they can write letters. It was our responsibility. The independence or the independent country, we would be the ones who will be in the forefront to actually take part in ruling our own country. And so it was important that we made sure that we were free from the colonial rule.
The crucial role that women played in the fight against colonialism cannot be overstated. Their contributions, sacrifices, and determination paved the way for the Zambia we know today. Rosemary Kamanga, ZNBC News, Lusaka.
In our conversation, on Zambia's economic journey, 6 decades of change. Let's take a listen.
In the early years of Zambia's independence, the economy remained largely in the hands of foreign companies and colonial structures. The majority of Zambians were spectators in an economy that thrived on their land, but not for their benefit, as only a few were absorbed on the labor market. Major industries such as manufacturing, copper mines, commercial farms were controlled by foreign interests. It was this imbalance that drove First Republican President Kenneth Kaunda's vision for economic liberation to build an economy owned and shaped by Zambians. In April 1968, at the historic Mulungushi Rock of Authority, Dr. Kaunda announced what would become known as the Mulungushi Reforms, a decisive move to acquire 51% stake in major foreign-owned businesses, including mining and manufacturing. Mark Chona, who served as special advisor to President Kaunda, played a key role in shaping Zambia's economic direction during that time.
After independence, the government, new government, faced a serious situation of disproportionate allocation of resources. White education was better. White farming community were better. And many others. So President Kaunda immediately introduced the Emergency Development Plan.
Just a year later, the material reforms of 1969 followed, and this time the focus was on rural development.
President Kaunda introduced programs like Kafue Textiles, Kafue Nitrogen Chemicals, Notech was improved in Ndola. President Kaunda then thought of East, and of course he put a bicycle factory, a motor assembly in Livingston. In Northern Province there was coffee and tea plantations. So in each province he did a project to make sure that the people were actually primary producers.
Dr. Chiselewe Ngandwe, the first chief executive officer appointed by Dr. Kaunda to manage SIDO, a small industries development organization, SIDO, speaks about the vision.
KK nationalized businesses so that he could give Zambians, through the government, a role to play in ownership and management. Mm-hmm. And that was very successful because it created the middle class in Zambia. And it was a very visionary idea by KK's government to set up armor mills so that we could reduce dependency on big-scale milling companies for the basic food, mill meal.
Today, University of Zambia senior lecturer Dr. Dale Mudenda describes Dr. Kaunda as a nationalist who had a vision and a heart for the Zambian people.
By 1969, he thought that we could empower the Zambian people by only allowing the key players in the wholesale sector, but then give the retail sector to the Zambian people. That was aimed at creating an acumen of entrepreneurship among Zambians, do business development processes, and ensure that the Zambians are already established into the business acumen and can perform. And you can guess.
And as Zambia celebrates another year of independence, the Mulungushan material reforms stands as symbols of a nation's courage to reclaim its economic destiny. Ellen Hambuba, ZNBC News, Lusaka.
Tech experts call for public-private action in order to help bridge Africa's digital divide.
Mobile phones, laptops and other smart devices have become essential tools of daily life in today's digital and AI-driven world. Across Africa, mobile technology is transforming lives, from mobile banking to e-health to education and agriculture. With 4G and 5G networks expanding, the continent is unlocking new digital opportunities. However, a wide gap still remains in access to these mobile tools between the rich and the poor, according to experts.
Africa, there's been a lot of progress that have been made over the last 15 years. Connectivity has increased, the footprint has increased, but the usage has not followed. We still have about 60% of usage gap. So it means that those are places where people are connected, but they are not using the internet. Why? Because of essentially two things. Number one is the cost of devices. It's still expensive for so many people. And secondly, because they are not skilled to use this.
Today, Rwanda's mobile operators cover almost 99% of the country. They enable close to 13 million connections, and the numbers continue to grow. Of course, there's still more work to do to make sure that everyone, everywhere has access to the transformational benefits of the mobile internet.
Here in Kigali, thousands of tech leaders, innovators and policymakers are gathered for the Mobile World Congress, Africa's biggest connectivity event. They agree connectivity is the foundation of Africa's digital economy, unlocking jobs, education and essential services. But a major challenge remains. Millions still live within network range, yet stay offline due to the cost of data and limited digital skills. Rwanda's president, Paul Kagame, says these challenges also present opportunities, urging Africa to harmonize its policies for a shared digital future.
While the challenges Africa faces are significant, they also offer great growth potential if we collaborate. Governments, the private sector, and other partners should harmonize policies and create the right environment for innovation. This will enable our data and payment systems to flow securely across borders and connect.
According to the International Telecommunication Union, achieving meaningful global connectivity by 2030 could cost up to $2.8 trillion, with Africa accounting for $900 billion of that investment. Today, about 416 million Africans use mobile internet, but nearly three quarters of the population remains offline. Across the continent, 960 million people, including 790 million in sub-Saharan Africa, live within mobile coverage, yet do not use it, making Africa home to the world's largest connectivity gap.
As Africa continues to embrace emerging mobile technologies, the message from the Mobile World Congress is clear. Bridging its digital divide will be central to shaping its future economy and driving its digital ambitions. Ethan Toshibia for CGTN, Kigali, Rwanda.
And with that being said, we have officially come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. To stay tuned for the Onkana Ndenge program brought to you by Eloise Shimi, and thereafter the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut from 16:30. Also, don't forget to tune in for the Business Economic segment with David Chombe from 1800 hours. Now from Indafa, happy Juju, it is goodbye. Have yourself a wonderful Wednesday afternoon ahead. And see you again, same time, same place tomorrow, right here on Eagle FM Radio or Eagle FM Frequency. So Eagle FM website for another episode of On the Radar News Analysis from 1300 hours up until 1430. Goodbye.